and to the husband, whereupon the Judiciary Committee declared a 15-minute recess so that Ginsburg's Thorazine could kick in. Despite the fact that Ginsburg was obviously crazier than a bedbug, Republicans didn't even oppose her on the merits. They certainly did not produce some long-ago co-worker to level outrageous sexual harassment charges against her. Then-Senate Republican leader Bob Dole of Kansas said of Ginsburg's nomination to the highest court in the land, "It looks like a good choice." Republican Senator Charles Grassley said, "She's a Democrat nominee that even conservatives can like and respect." Former Grassley aide Samuel Giordano said the Senate hearing on Ginsburg was like Barney the Dinosaur for adults. I love you, you love me. In other words, both Republicans and Democrats engage in mud-throwing, gutter politics over Supreme Court nominations. It is also not true that both Republicans and Democrats failed to do enough to prevent the 9/11 terrorist attack. We wouldn't have mentioned it if Democrats hadn't started blaming the Bush administration for failing to stop 9/11, but gee, I kind of remembered it was the Democrats who imposed absurd restrictions on law enforcement and spent the last three decades trying to bulldoze the CIA and FBI. But I must be wrong. Otherwise, how could Democrats have the effrontery to complain about the FBI and CIA not having done enough to stop 9/11. In the early 1970s, when Democrats had dominant majorities in both houses of Congress, the Church Committee, so named for its chairman, Democratic Senator Frank Church, went after the CIA like it was going after the Nazis. The agency was gutted, hampered, and hamstrung with endless bureaucratic regulations. In 1980, Congressman Ron Dellums, California Democrat, who believed that Fidel Castro would have been right during the great conflict known as the Cold War, vowed to totally dismantle every intelligence agency in this country, piece by piece, nail by nail, brick by brick. In 1993, the Democratic caucus voted Dellums, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, in a 198-10 vote. The New York Times took the occasion to shower Dellums with praise. Throughout the 1990s, Senator John Kerry repeatedly voted to cut billions of dollars from intelligence services so money spent fighting terrorism could be spent on something more important, like reducing class size. In a 1997 speech on the Senate floor, Kerry bleated, "Why is it that our vast intelligence apparatus continues to grow even as government resources for new and essential priorities fall far short of what is necessary?" There were half a dozen terrorist attacks on Clinton's watch. All of them went unanswered. Ronald Reagan responded more forcefully to Islamic terrorism when he was busy toppling a 50-year-old evil empire. Clinton was in office for 8 years preceding the 9/11 attack. Bush had been in office for less than 8 months. Most enragingly, everything liberals complain Bush was not doing before the 9/11 attack is what they are furious at him for doing after the 9/11 attack. So let's review. Which party was constantly trying to strip intelligence agencies of money? Which party made it impossible for the CIA and the FBI to talk to each other? Which party demands proof that crime was committed before allowing law enforcement to look for evidence? Which party was responsible for preventing the government from opening Massawi's laptop? I think we're talking about the Democrats and their pals. Rules that Republicans disagreed with were put in place over their objections, which prevented them from doing a better job in ferreting out a terrorist plot before it was executed on 9/11. And then the Democrats have the chutzpah to blame Republicans for not breaking the laws, Democrats wrote. In response to this, Republicans think it's a great comeback to say both parties were equally responsible for the flaws in law enforcement that failed to prevent 9/11. Finally, it is not true that George Bush would have behaved like Al Gore after the 2000 election had the situation been reversed. This is patently absurd, but it is an absurdity that has gained credibility with the left's usual mind-numbing repetition. As luck would have it, I know how conservatives would have responded if Bush had lost the election while winning the popular vote. The day before the 2000 election, I was at the editorial meeting of Human Events, Ronald Reagan's favorite newspaper and the most influential conservative publication in America. Editor Terry Jeffrey began the meeting by raising the prospect of Gore's winning the Electoral College and losing the popular vote. Everyone forgot this later, but before the election, that was considered the more likely prospect. No one seems to have ever imagined that the reverse would occur. Jeffrey said if Gore won the Electoral College and lost the popular vote, Human Events would run a front-page article vehemently defending the Electoral College. No one at the meeting disagreed. Of course, you don't have to take my word for it. The entire world knows how a Republican presidential candidate would react to winning the popular vote but losing the Electoral College because that's exactly what happened in 1960. Despite the myth of John F. Kennedy's popular vote victory in 1960, more popular votes were cast for Richard Nixon that year. As Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Walter A. McDougall explained in an op-ed in the New York Times, in the 1960 election, Kennedy did not win all the Democratic ballots in Alabama. Five Democratic independent electors cast their votes for Senator Harry Byrd's segregationist States' Rights Democratic Party that year. Thus, McDougall notes, at least 173,620 Alabama Democrats were not voting for Kennedy on Election Day. Democrat voters and States' Rights Democratic Party voters together won the national popular vote in 1960 by only 113,000 votes. So that means Kennedy actually lost the popular vote by about 60,000 votes. And this isn't including the massive vote fraud in Illinois and Texas. The myth of Kennedy's popular vote victory in 1960, McDougall says, was started by Kennedy admirers in journalism and the academy, who at some point began counting the popular votes for Byrd in Alabama as popular votes for Kennedy. Nixon's response to losing the Electoral College while winning the popular vote was to concede the election. Al Gore showed the world how a Democrat responds. So which man goes down in history as shredding the Constitution? After the 2000 election, the media simply assumed that conservatives would have thrown a tantrum had the shoe been on the other foot. One much-trumpeted article by Daily News reporter Michael Kramer had quoted an anonymous Bush aide before the election saying Bush planned to stage a major assault on the election if he lost the Electoral College but won the popular vote. Adding credibility to Kramer's account, the anonymous Bush aide predicted that if Bush challenged the election, the media would back him. Yep, Republicans can often be found whiling away the days boasting about how pro-Republican the media is. And if all else fails, we can always count on NPR. But according to Kramer, Mr. Anonymous said, "I think you can count on the media to fuel the thing big time. Even papers that supported Gore might turn against him because the will of the people will have been thwarted." Mr. Anonymous also confided to Kramer, "You think Democrats for Democracy would be a catchy term for them? In fairness, it sure beats the people, not the powerful." I gather by Bush aide, Kramer meant some guy I met on a bus. Inasmuch as the chairman of the Democratic National Committee has gone on CBS's Face the Nation and called me, an opinion columnist with no connection whatsoever to the Republican Party or George Bush, a top Republican operative, what liberals mean by terms like Republican operative and Republican aide is rather broad, including anyone to the right of Barbara Streisand. While Human Events was prepared to back Gore if he was the Electoral College winner, liberals' affection for the Electoral College seems to depend on how the election comes out, revealing the essence of being a liberal, the absolute conviction that there is one set of rules for you and another completely different set of rules for everyone else. Before the election, when Gore was the one who was supposed to win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote, University of Southern California law professor Erwin Chemerinsky stated categorically, "The Constitution says that it is the Electoral College that determines who is the president. It leaves no doubt." But after Gore lost the Electoral College, Chemerinsky found room for doubt. This apparently follows from Chemerinsky's notion that the Constitution is a living document, as in Dr. Frankenstein screeching, "It's alive! It's alive!" In the Los Angeles Times, Chemerinsky demanded that Florida's 25 electoral votes be split evenly between Bush and Gore in order to effectuate the will of the people. Florida voters had divided their votes evenly, giving about 3 million votes apiece to Bush and Gore. Thus, Chemerinsky said, their will was to split their Electoral College votes. But that's not how the Electoral College works. It was the will of 42% of California voters that Bush get their Electoral College votes, and yet every single one of California's 54 electoral votes went to Gore. Chemerinsky was not so troubled about ignoring the will of 4.6 million Bush voters in California. As we know from the media consortium that examined Florida ballots after Gore finally conceded, Bush would have won under every recount requested by any party or ordered by any court. But it took the media consortium 11 months of playing Karnak with Florida ballots to tell us that. Had the Democrats gotten their way, Florida election officials still would have been holding ballots to the light by the fairly important date of September 11, 2001. November 7, 2000. The networks incorrectly call a Gore victory in Florida while the polls are still open in the Florida panhandle, suppressing the vote for Bush, who still wins. The networks switch their call to Bush. Gore concedes the election and then retracts his concession, beginning our long election nightmare. Elections in Clintonville. November 10, 2000. I have a sick, sinking feeling. It's impeachment all over again. But this time, it's about the results of a presidential election. Like his mentor, Bill Clinton, Al Gore is willing to precipitate a constitutional crisis in order to hold on to power. Democrats are going to turn the world's most successful method of transferring power into another O.J. slow-speed car chase. I no longer care about taxes, abortion, affirmative action. I just want to be rid of these people. Gore's endgame is to delay confirmation of the Florida vote for as long as possible, just the way his role model of a boss would in these circumstances. Maybe Hillary can find some extra Gore votes in the White House living quarters, where she found those missing Whitewater files that had been under subpoena for 2 years. Under the 12th Amendment, the president is to be chosen by a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. If Gore can prevent Florida from appointing its electors by December 18th, when the electors meet, Florida's electors will be excluded. Gore will win with 260 electoral votes. In football, this is known as running out the clock. In politics, it's called cheating. Gore has a number of stratagems for throwing roadblocks in the way of Florida's appointing electors, mostly featuring time-consuming legal challenges. Nostalgic Stalinists from Brooklyn, now transplanted to Florida in their dotage, have already trotted out lawsuits demanding a second chance to vote because they were confused by the ballot. I've been to law school, and I've still never heard of the stupidity clause. It doesn't matter that Gore's legal machinations are precisely as meritorious as President Clinton's Secret Service privilege claim. If enough lawsuits are filed, maybe Gore will win the lottery. But in any event, pointless litigation buys him more time. The law schools are chock-full of droning professors who will attest to the legitimacy of the Democrats' phony legal claims. Having rested up from impeachment and the OJ trial, they're ready to tackle a presidential election. Liberals have even dusted off the old impeachment catchphrases, condescendingly instructing the public not to make a rush to judgment and to take a deep breath. As with impeachment, the spin is having its effect. We've gone from a Bush win, subject to a single state's recount, to the next president, whoever that may be. We've gone from this will be resolved by 5 p.m. tomorrow to this could take weeks. We've gone from rolling our eyes at hapless old people claiming they slipped and voted for the wrong guy to Morton Kondracki saying of the ballot, well, yeah, sure, now it looks easy. We've gone from stark horror at the idea of a hostile takeover determining the next leader of the free world to New York Times lawyer Floyd Abrams saying that lawsuits are part of the process. Perhaps strangest of all, the networks have taken the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, and begun referring to it as merely a saying, a proverb, even a blessing. We are being inured to the proposition that Bush has not won, inured to the idea that any states and districts that Gore lost should be subject to a do-over, inured to the idea that meaningless expressions of popular approval should prevail over constitutional mechanisms for selecting the president, inured to the notion that the presidential election is not decided on election day, or even the next day, but can sometimes be a months-long process. Once we were shocked by the suggestion that the president could be shown to have committed felonies and still continue in office, but after a while we got used to that too. This isn't a 2 out of 3 match. If it were, Bush would have won already. If Gore loses the third recount, which may have been mercifully curtailed by the time we go to press, there will be a fourth. Even if we pretend there is no such thing as a deadline, it is simply not the case that each recount increases the accuracy of the vote count. Each recount increases the number of scores we have. It does not increase their accuracy. As statisticians quoted in the New York Times have said, every time you count large numbers, you're going to get a different answer. Democrats will not accept a recount as true and accurate until they finally concoct one that makes Gore the winner. When and if that happens, righteous prigs in the Republican Party will somberly call on Bush to concede to show how honorable we are, forgetting the little detail about Bush having already won. Even when they've won, Republicans instinctively lunge toward defeat. In response to the insanely partisan recount of 3 Democratic districts in Florida, many Republican flacks simply demanded that Republican counties be included in the hand recount, too. How about this for a Republican bargaining position? Bush won. Let's move on, as they used to say about a certain felon in the White House. John O'Sullivan, editor-at-large of National Review, has counseled losing, saying a Gore presidency could be a blessing in disguise, in light of the fact that the economy is likely to tank during the next president's term. That certainly is a good disguise. It bears not the slightest resemblance to a blessing. Republicans have gotten good at losing, and they want to stick with what they're good at. I'm not convinced you ever really hit pay dirt by losing, but I am positive it's not a good idea right now. It's bad enough for Americans to have witnessed a known lawbreaker sitting in the Oval Office. Criminal methods, perjury, obstruction of justice, witness tampering, using the instruments of federal government to intimidate witnesses, all these have been shown to work. On the heels of a Clinton presidency, it cannot be good for the country to watch a presidential election being openly stolen by the horny Hicks vice president. To put it in liberal terms, letting Gore steal this election might send the wrong signal. On day two of America Held Hostage, former President George Bush, father of President-elect Bush, was on television commending his son for the dignity he had shown during this national emergency. "Yes, we're all very proud. Al Gore, the Rube, has demanded a recount in Florida, while Bush has decorously refrained from requesting recounts in Iowa, Wisconsin, and New Mexico, not to mention Missouri, where anti-Bush vote fraud was credibly charged." Bush's brother, the Florida governor, graciously removed himself from involvement in the Florida recount, but Florida's attorney general, who happens to be Al Gore's campaign chairman in that state, boorishly did not. Al Gore goes around loudishly declaring himself the popular vote champion, while Bush genteelly refrains from any such boasts. The symbol for the Democratic Party shouldn't be a donkey. It should be two sets of standards. This is no time for Republicans to be putting their good breeding on display. The Democrats have declared war. Jesse Jackson is presiding over rioting in the streets. There is a movement afoot to call in Janet Reno. Maybe she could send federal troopers to Midland, Texas, to gas George Bush. All we need now are chickens in the street and beggars with leprosy to complete the picture. This is no time for dignity. President Bush had dignity. Senator Bob Dole had dignity. They lost. In particular, they lost to the two blackguards in the White House, now dragging the country into yet another constitutional crisis. It will never end until these people are gone. It's time for Bush to stop acting like a lockjaw Connecticut wasp and start acting like a Texan. November 11, 2000. Bush files suit in federal district court, arguing that the selective recounts violate the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. November 13, 2000. U.S. District Court Judge Donald M. Middlebrooks, appointed by Clinton, finds that the selective recounts do not violate the Constitution and orders the partial hand recount to continue. New Equal Protection Clause. One man, several votes. November 13, 2000. As Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin said, it doesn't matter who votes, it only matters who counts the ballots. That's just what Al Gore is betting on as he demands his third recount in Florida, this one conducted exclusively in Democratic bastions such as Palm Beach County. A selective hand recount is calculated to ensure that Gore's margin will increase, even if an equal number of Bush votes were missed by voting machines statewide. Any hand recount will increase the total number of votes cast by resuscitating formerly invalid ballots, even ballots that would never be accepted by any voting machine, and the revived ballots will tend to reflect the voting preferences of the district. So hand recounts conducted only in counties Gore 1 will undoubtedly swell his votes. This is like having mothers judge their own babies in a beauty contest. No one even remotely familiar with the principles of free and fair elections would allow such a procedure to take place, which may explain why we haven't heard from Jimmy Carter. The media have been portraying the Bush legal team's argument as a general attack on all hand recounts. That's part of it, certainly, which should not come as a surprise to anyone who has seen the nudniks counting ballots on TV, holding punch cards to the light, interpreting smudge marks on the ballots, and consulting tarot cards to divine the voters' elusive intent. This could be the first time in U.S. history the results of a presidential election are determined by TV psychic Miss Cleo. The room for error, manipulation, and general mayhem is gargantuan. Punch card ballots are not like wine. They do not improve with age. Not only do different counties have different rules about how to read the animal entrails, but whenever humans are introduced into any process, there will be errors. Ask NASA about that Mars landing. But Bush has a separate equal protection argument that does not indict hand counts across the board, but only hand counts conducted exclusively in three lucky Florida Democratic counties. Voters in only certain select counties get to have their ballots given an extra visual inspection, while voters in other counties are denied the right to a visual inspection of their ballots. Allowing the voters of only certain Democratic counties two chances to have their ballots read, first by machine, then by hand, while allowing voters in the rest of the state only one chance to have their ballots read, by machine only, is as unconstitutional as a state's giving Democratic counties 2 days to vote and Republican counties only 1 day. Only an insane, rogue judge would allow such a selective recount to take place. Let's just hope this doesn't end up in the Florida Supreme Court. It is true, as Gore's combatants never tire of pointing out, that the scam they've pulled off is permitted under Florida law, which allows candidates to request hand recounts in particular counties within a specified time period after an election. But we have a tradition in this country of striking down state laws that violate the U.S. Constitution. It is hardly ironic, the Democrats' attack du jour, for Republicans to argue that the Florida law is unconstitutional. Respecting states' rights does not mean respecting a state's right to enforce unconstitutional laws. Even assuming Bush was ambushed, and it's his own fault for not demanding a hand recount in Republican-leaning districts, neither Bush nor any candidate has the right to waive someone else's constitutional rights. If Florida citizens have an equal protection right to have their votes count as much as those of citizens who live in other parts of the state, this is not a right that can be taken away by state law, or the happenstance of one candidate not asking for a recount because he already won the election. There isn't a lot of relevant precedent. It's not often someone tries to steal a presidential election. But in a case called O'Brien v. Skinner, 414 U.S. 524, 1974, the Supreme Court struck down a New York election law less insane than the three-county hand count in Florida. The law at issue in O'Brien permitted pre-trial detainees to obtain absentee ballots only if they were jailed in a county other than the county of their residence, while inhabitants of jails in the counties of their residence were denied absentee ballots. Because the law distinguished voting rights on the basis of one's residence, the court held, it placed an unconstitutionally onerous burden on the exercise of the franchise. But now a federal judge appointed by Clinton found that a state's decision to give the ballots of only some lucky Democratic counties an extra visual inspection based solely on the county of their residence doesn't violate the Equal Protection Clause. How odd that a Bill Clinton appointee could have so little regard for the Constitution. If nothing else, at least it can now be said. The U.S. Supreme Court is more solicitous of the voting rights of the criminally accused than a Clinton-appointed judge is solicitous of the voting rights of Republicans. The Liar Next Time, November 14, 2000. In a fast-breaking story like the Democrats' attempt to steal a presidential election, it can be hard to keep up with the barrage of lies. Before today's lies become old news, I thought it would be useful to begin a running tabulation. A recount shall be ordered in Democratic counties only. Lie number one. We don't know who won the election yet. Yes, we do. George W. Bush won, albeit extremely narrowly, in one state with a total of 271 electoral votes. Al Gore demanded a recount in one of the states he lost narrowly. After the Gore loser got his recount, it turned out the winner was Bush again, subject only to a final count of the overseas ballots, which have historically gone Republican in Florida and elsewhere. Consequently, Gore insisted upon yet a third count, this time with a highly manipulable and probably unconstitutional hand recount in Democratic counties only. By his fourth try, Gore will be insisting on counting only the ballots of Gore campaign staff. Lie number two. Gore has nothing to do with the Florida recount, which is mandated by law. This is false. Gore is completely responsible for dragging the country through this nightmare. The recount is not like some unstoppable Star Chamber death warrant. Gore set the recount in motion when he retracted his concession to Bush on election night. The "shall order a recount" language means only that the loser doesn't have to pay for a recount in close elections. This is not an insignificant point. Recounts are extremely expensive. But it does not mean that in a national election to determine the next leader of the free world, the loser is absolutely required to drag the country through 17 recounts and endless litigation before finally conceding. The Florida recount provision explicitly states, a recount need not be ordered with respect to the returns for any office. However, if the candidate or candidates defeated request in writing that a recount not be made. The current crisis is all Gore's fault. He could put an end to this madness at any time by conceding like a man. Bush can't stop it because he's not the loser. Gore is. Lie number three. The butterfly ballot is illegal under Florida law. In the November 10th Washington Post, Philip Heyman, former Harvard Law School professor and Clinton deputy attorney general, claimed that the now infamous butterfly ballot was a plain violation of the law. What a pity that so many Florida precinct chiefs, almost all of them Democrats, approved of the butterfly ballot before the election. Heyman said the law requires voters to vote for a candidate whose name is printed on the ballot, place a cross, X mark in the blank space at the right of the name of the candidate. Section 101.151. The critical point, he said, is that the butterfly ballot sometimes required voters to mark on the right, as the law required, and sometimes on the left. It might have struck a lot of readers that in addition to stating that the mark must be on the right, the law requires a cross X mark to be put on the ballot. The butterfly ballot does not permit cross marks any place. Stay with me here because this can get pretty confusing if you've never completed the Think and Do section in a Highlights magazine. Apparently, what voters are required to do with a butterfly ballot is find the name of their preferred candidate, follow the arrow from his name to a circle, and punch a hole in the circle. It's all quite baffling. And thank heaven we have fancy, high-priced lawyers to explain complicated legal issues like this. The reason the circles were not at the right of candidate names on the butterfly ballot is that the at the right requirement has nothing to do with butterfly ballots. That phrase comes from a chapter tellingly titled Voting by Paper Ballot. You know, the kind of ballot on which it is possible to place a cross, X mark in the blank space, not to be confused with a butterfly ballot. If you read down just a little bit, down past the section on paper ballots, there is a completely different chapter titled Voting Machine Ballots, which would include butterfly ballots. This section clearly states that the location of the push knob, key, lever, or other device must simply indicate to the elector which candidate the push knob, key, lever, or other device refers to. Remember this episode the next time you hear a Harvard law professor rambling on about what the law requires. Lie number four. Pat Buchanan could not possibly have received 3,000-odd votes in Palm Beach County. Just 4 years ago, Pat Buchanan received three times that many votes in a primary in Palm Beach. A primary. So we know there are at least 9,000 potential Buchanan voters in Palm Beach, and they're the kind of dedicated voters who come out for primaries. This year, The Reform Party candidate for the House of Representatives received over 7,000 votes from Palm Beach. Lie number 5. I believe President Clinton. Whoops, that's old news. This is what the Electoral College is supposed to prevent. November 16, 2000. Like many of you, I've been on tenterhooks waiting for New York's junior senator to weigh in on the Electoral College. Just days after her election, Hillary finally ended the suspense. She vowed to combat the Electoral College so that the popular vote, the will of the people, will reign triumphant. Where was all this concern for the will of the people when she was trying to shove Hillary care down our throats? It should come as no surprise that Hillary opposes the Electoral College. Alexander Hamilton explained that the whole point of the Electoral College was to interpose every practicable obstacle to cabal, intrigue, and corruption, which, interestingly enough, are the three virtues embossed on the Clinton family coat of arms. The Constitution's roundabout method of choosing a president was intended to frustrate the adversaries of Republican government and prevent them from gaining an improper ascendant in our councils. The framers opposed a pure popular vote for president, believing it would reward oily candidates practiced, as Hamilton put it, in Federalist No. 68, at the little arts of popularity, such as feeling our pain. Instead of relying upon existing bodies of men who might be tampered with beforehand to prostitute their votes, the people would vote for electors, and the electors would have the temporary and sole purpose of choosing the president. The system obviously isn't foolproof. Bill Clinton slipped through the net. But the Electoral College has largely been free of the corrupting influences that worried the framers. Electors have occasionally wandered off the reservation, as in 1988, when a lone Dukakis elector cast his vote for Lloyd Benson, but as a group, they've been pretty incorruptible. No elector has ever been convicted of taking bribes, as judges and members of Congress have been. The profoundly senile are generally not chosen to be electors, but they can and often do attempt to vote in Palm Beach County. The New York Times has never run an op-ed piece proposing that electors trade their votes, as it did recently with regard to Nader and Gore voters trading popular votes across state lines. Electors have never been stolen outright by a Chicago mayor or Texas precinct captain, as popular votes have been. If you try to dump 10,000 electors into Lake Michigan, somebody's bound to notice. The Electoral College is supposed to be enigmatic and complex, the better to foil foreign powers, cabals, and other enemies of Republican government, as Hamilton put it. It remains to be seen if the Electoral College can frustrate the Clintonized Democratic Party. The current crisis foisted on the nation by Al Gore illustrates with some clarity the sort of mischief the Electoral College is intended to prevent. By tallying presidential votes state by state, the Electoral College isolates the effect of voter fraud in any one state. If the national total were up for grabs, the whole country would quickly be initiated into the Chicago vote-stealing customs now taking place in Florida. Mysterious ballot boxes would be turning up in every black church in America. Hapless old people nationwide would be taking to the airwaves to claim they were really trying to order a Whopper, but somehow ended up voting for Pat Buchanan. Homeless people in Milwaukee would be bribed with cartons of cigarettes to vote for Al Gore. Wait, that one actually happened. Even assuming Gore's popular vote advantage holds, and Bush's numbers would surely be higher if the media hadn't incorrectly projected a Gore win in Florida before the polls closed, the candidates' nationwide tallies are separated by a sneeze. At some point, you have to cut off debate, or there will be chaos and warfare. People can't live like liberals, endlessly jawboning hypothetical possibilities and refusing to submit to rules. This is America, not the UN. If a lawyer is one day late filing the complaint, Granny loses her slip and fall case. That's how rules work. There have to be institutional boundaries to curtail endless navel-gazing. Legitimate claims, which Gore's is not, are sometimes devalued for a stable social order. More horrifying than the curious prospect of a popular vote winner losing the electoral vote is the fact that Hillary Cattle Futures Clinton is going to be a United States senator. But those are the rules, and we've learned to live with that. The Electoral College establishes a set of rules, and those rules make Bush the winner. Bush has already won more popular votes than Bill Clinton got in either of his elections. You remember Clinton. He was the guy liberals said we couldn't impeach because that would overturn the results of an election. The law, not the court, has the last word. November 20th, 2000, the day before Florida's kangaroo court issued its first opinion on Gore's tantrum. It ought to be apparent from the way the media have been carrying on about the highly respected Florida Supreme Court that the court is on the verge of openly violating the law. By the time this early Thanksgiving issue arrives in your mailbox, the court's willful disregard of the law will probably have attained the status of hard fact. The portion of Florida election law the court intends to violate is this, Section 102.111. If the county returns are not received by the Department of State by 5 p.m. of the seventh day following an election, all missing counties shall be ignored, and the results shown by the returns on file shall be certified, part to be flagrantly violated by the Florida Supreme Court in italics. Note that the law, duly enacted by the other two branches of Florida government, does not say that results submitted past the deadline may be ignored. It says shall be ignored. Note that it also does not say shall be ignored unless the Florida Supreme Court disagrees because Al Gore needs more time to steal votes. There's also no reference here to confused elderly Jews. That's not the only provision in Florida law that makes the seven-day deadline for submitting election returns mandatory. Section 102.112, helpfully titled Deadline for Submission of County Returns to the Department of State, Penalties, states again, unequivocally, returns must be filed by 5 p.m. on the seventh day following the general election, part to be flagrantly violated by the Florida Supreme Court in italics. Under the law, the only person who has discretion to waive the mandatory seven-day deadline is Florida's Secretary of State. If the returns are not received by the Department of State by the time specified, such returns may be ignored and the results on file at that time may be certified by the department, part to be flagrantly violated by the Florida Supreme Court in italics. Whether or not the Secretary of State, in her discretion, accepts any late-filed election returns, she is commanded to fine each board member of the county election board $200 for each day such returns are late, the fine to be paid only from the board member's personal funds. So the seven-day deadline imposed by law is pretty unambiguous. Two sections of Florida law make the deadline mandatory, shall be ignored, and must be filed. Another gives the Secretary of State discretion to ignore any late-filed returns, may be ignored, in which case the delinquent board members are to be fined personally. There are a lot of murky, complex issues in the law. This isn't one of them. Naturally, therefore, the Democrats argue that the seven-day deadline imposed by Florida law is optional, just a suggestion, non-binding thoughts tossed out by the legislature, something akin to Democrats' view of the commandments against lying and adultery. You're free to take it or leave it. The New York Times has referred to the Republicans' contention that state law allowed no leeway in the deadline. Unambiguous statements of the law are now called mere contentions of Republicans. Al Gore lost the election, lost the recount, and also lost the third manual recount to the point permitted by law. Now he wants a bunch of corrupt judges to change the law 2 weeks after the election has taken place to give him yet a fourth opportunity to steal enough votes to win. And the highly respected Florida Supreme Court will probably let him. Leave it to Democrats to turn a presidential election into the sequel to The Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia. Not to worry, though. The Florida Supreme Court justices may think they have the powers of Pol Pot, but there are other branches of government capable of following the law, despite the rulings of this kangaroo court. One surmises that Secretary of State Katherine Harris will have some crucial role to play. The giveaway is that Harris hasn't done anything yet, but she is already being viciously attacked by the Democrats' election-stealing task force. Harris has been called a crook by OJ and Clinton defender Alan Dershowitz. She has been called a hack and Soviet commissar by Gore spokesman Chris Lehane. Liberals take a principled stand against the death penalty in all circumstances, except in cases of killing the messenger. The Washington Post devoted an entire article to sneering about Harris's makeup. They were the eyelashes of Tammy Faye, cartoon lashes. She looked as if she were wearing a mask. To be honest, she seems to have applied her makeup with a trowel. Would that the evil Katherine Harris were a ravishing sexpot like Janet Reno or Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is the same crowd that will tell you with a straight face that Bill Clinton is handsome, exhibit A of people being literally blinded by their ideology. Harris is getting the Linda Tripp treatment from liberals because she seems like the sort of person inclined to follow the law. Democrats hate that. The Florida Supreme Court they can work with. Obsessive rule followers are the bane of Democrats' existence. Suppose the Florida Supreme Court directs the Secretary of State to violate the law, as they surely will, by ordering Harris not to ignore election returns submitted after the mandatory statutory deadline she is required by law to follow. Should Harris obey the written law, enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor, prior to knowing whom the law would benefit? Or should Harris follow the results-oriented, lawless ruling of seven judges, all appointed during Democratic administrations, intended to give a Democratic presidential candidate yet a fourth shot at stealing an election he's already lost? That's a tough one. The rule of law or a partisan scam, which should prevail? Either way, Harris will be violating some official decree. Harris ought to follow the real law. That's not going to be easy. The Washington Post's attacks on Harris's mascara are just a sample of what is to come if Harris fails to obey a dishonest ruling from the kangaroo court. The Washington Post has a rapid response team fully assembling even now, prepared to attack Harris's hair, her wardrobe, even her accessorizing, if it will help Al Gore. If Harris follows the written law, the Florida Attorney General, Bob Butterworth, also known as Gore's Florida campaign chairman, may well try to prosecute Harris for violating a court order. In the end, it might dawn on the members of the Florida Supreme Court that other government officials will be reviewing their handiwork. The U.S. Supreme Court might do loopy things from time to time, but it's hard to imagine that the justices could miss the unmistakable language of Florida's 7-day deadline on election returns. It's also hard to imagine that they would overlook the rank corruption inherent in a court altering the rules for judging a presidential election after the election has already been held. If the Florida Supreme Court judges are not as stupid as they are partisan, the court might well follow the law to avoid being overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court and shut down this nightmare once and for all. But I wouldn't count on it. The most ethical administration in history can't seem to leave without giving the country one last kick in the pants. November 21st, 2000. The Florida Supreme Court orders manual recounts to continue until November 26th or early November 27th. Certify the electors, then the judges. November 22, 2000. After having denounced the Florida Supreme Court as a corrupt and dishonest kangaroo court long before its lawless ruling earlier this week, I'm kind of relieved that they didn't prove me wrong. Still, it's breathtaking how totally detached from any sort of legal reasoning the court's decision is. While taking a sledgehammer to the law, this Warren court with a thyroid condition insisted it was engaging in a delicate and serious balancing analysis, affording due concern to competing interests. Except the problem is, that's not their job. The Florida legislature had already engaged in a balancing of competing interests, and it came to a different conclusion. Taking into account many and various factors, finality, accuracy, sore losers demanding interminable recounts, and so on, the Florida legislature decided that counties would be permitted to indulge in all the recounting they desired, but then they had to turn in their election returns 7 days after the election. The decision of where to strike the balance has already been made and enacted in law, written by the legislature, signed by the governor, put on the Florida statute books. But Al Gore lost the election, lost the recount, lost the absentee ballot returns, and lost all the manual recounts that could be completed within 7 days. So he asked the Florida Supreme Court to give him more time to keep recounting, relying on Bill Daley's genetic vote-counting skills to eventually make him the winner. The problem was that pesky 7-day deadline, a.k.a. the law. The Florida Supreme Court was not interpreting an ambiguous statute, resolving a conflict, or filling in a blank space in the law. What Gore requested and what the kangaroo court granted was a judicial coup overturning the unambiguous 7-day deadline put on the books by the other two branches of government and replacing it with a 19-day deadline. The court papered over its lawless ruling with this inane sophistry. If the law permits recounts, it must permit recounts to go on and on and on until the loser can finally steal enough votes to win, or the whole country dies of exhaustion. It is true that manual recounts are permitted by Florida law, but that doesn't mean there's no deadline. Gore may as well have argued that because there's Christmas shopping, there's no such thing as Christmas. You can shop and shop and shop, but Christmas imposes a deadline. Florida counties can indulge in recounts to their heart's desire, but 7 days after the election is the deadline. If Florida election law had a motto, it would be, when it absolutely, positively has to be filed within 7 days. To put the law in terms understandable to Democrats, you can give homeless people cigarettes in exchange for votes, you can register felons and illegal immigrants, you can count dimpled chads, animal entrails, ballots pulled out of disappearing votomatics. But you have to steal all the votes you're going to steal by 5 p.m. 7 days after the election. If Gore still hasn't won, you have to stop bothering everyone and go home. But Gore's idiotic demand found a receptive audience with the Florida Supreme Court. It appears that the justices' mental acuity has been impaired from the fumes of all those ambulances they spent their careers chasing. The Chief Justice of that court gave $500 to Clinton Gore in 1992, but did not recuse himself from a case in which Gore is a party, which at least reversed the usual flow of funds one expects in such a court. The justices claimed to be stumped by blindingly clear statements of the law. It's as if the justices of the Florida Supreme Court read Oliver Wendell Holmes's stirring words about judges having jurisdiction only to declare the law and not authority to make it, and said, huh? Does anybody know what that means? Now the whole country isn't sure whether to wait out the process or call 911. The Florida court's ruling is even more insane than the typical judicial imperialism. Usually, when judges are hankering to legislate, they choose territory where there is no written law at all. Where the law is silent, they concoct penumbras and emanations and discover hitherto unnoticed, invisible provisions. At least with Roe v. Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court invented clauses where the Constitution was silent. The Florida decision is even more lawless than Roe. Florida law isn't silent on the question of when the election is over. In no uncertain terms, the law imposes a mandatory 7-day deadline on the submission of election returns. The kangaroo court simply took the 7-day statutory deadline and replaced it with a 19-day deadline. Poor Secretary of State Katherine Harris is subject to directly opposed legal commands. She is, of course, required to follow Florida law, as are all Florida residents, except evidently judges, and Florida law explicitly directs her to ignore any election returns submitted after the 7-day deadline and to certify the electors. This is, quite literally, the job she swore an oath before God she would faithfully execute. But at the same time, the order of the Florida Supreme Court commands Harris to defy the law, the one duly enacted by proper legislative channels long before anyone knew precisely how much time Al Gore would need to steal votes, which is apparently 19 days. In order to follow the real law, she will have to violate the court's lunatic order. It's as if state law set a 60-mile-an-hour speed limit, and the Florida Supreme Court came along and ordered Katherine Harris to drive her car at 120 miles per hour and to disregard traffic signals, provided George W. Bush were in front of her car. Sane state officials in Florida still have to do their jobs. As Ken Starr can attest, Democrats make it extremely difficult for people to do their jobs when that consists of enforcing the law. But it's Katherine Harris's job to certify the electors as provided in the real law, 7-day deadline, and not the junta's manifesto, 19-day deadline, until we sober up long enough to start issuing more orders. The legislature has a responsibility to protect its authority to write laws and have them given effect. It should act promptly to confirm the electoral slate certified by Harris. And Governor Jeb Bush has a duty to enforce the law. We're sorry he's the president-elect's brother, but it was the networks that created this fiasco in Florida, rather than in a state where the president's brother is not the governor, by incorrectly calling the election for Gore while the polls were still open in Florida. Instead of being a gentleman to thieving Democrats, it's time for Jeb to exhibit a little of that famous Bush gallantry toward a beleaguered state official trying to obey the law. November 22, 2000. Gore says both he and Bush should start planning their White House transitions. November 24, 2000. After legal experts have assured us that the U.S. Supreme Court won't hear Bush's appeal of the Florida Supreme Court's decision, the court agrees to hear the case. November 26, 2000. Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris certifies the election results on the date set by the Florida Supreme Court. Bush wins a 537-vote victory over Gore. Things only a Democrat will say with a straight face. November 29, 2000. If you have any doubt that Al Gore's selfless pleas for democracy are part of his scheme to steal the election, consider this. In one of Gore's many pending lawsuits against the Florida election results, he asked the court to declare him the winner on the grounds that there are still thousands of votes to be counted. That's funny. If the ballots haven't been counted yet, how does he know he's the winner? In order to make sense of this, you have to presume that Gore won the election, as Gore clearly has done, and work backwards from there. In the category of things only a Democrat would say with a straight face, Florida State Representative Deborah Danberg told Chris Matthews on CNBC's Hardball that some voters meant to vote but didn't actually punch the ballot, for Gore, no doubt, because, I quote, they were afraid to hurt the machine. Unpunched ballots are a gold mine for Democrats. As we know from the chads littering the floors of the counting areas, these late-breaking votes are not being counted 3 weeks after the election. They are being cast. Through pure brazenness, Democrats are turning uncast votes into votes for Gore. We've entered the Alice in Wonderland realm of polls, spin, and counting earwax on punch card ballots. This is the liberals' playing field. Truth doesn't matter, honor doesn't matter, fairness doesn't matter. Once Democrats are freed from the tyranny of objectivity, they are liberated to lie and cheat and steal. Liberals always prefer spin to hard facts. They promote the concept of a living constitution unbounded by the objective and determinate words in the document. They want phony polls to determine constitutional questions like impeachment. They want the census to be determined by sampling rather than an actual enumeration as the Constitution specifies. They want criminals punished not merely for the act of, say, committing murder, but also on the basis of a subjective determination of whether the murder was committed out of hate, in contradistinction to all those crimes being committed out of love. They want SAT scores dropped as a criterion for college admissions, preferring purely subjective evaluations of the applicant's diversity. It's probably just a matter of time before someone in the Gore camp declares the recounts irrelevant because people have different ways of voting. After suffering through months and months of polls purporting to demonstrate that 20 million swing voters were wildly rushing back and forth each week from Bush to Gore, Gore to Bush, and on, finally, we took the only poll that counts. A focus group of 100 million Americans chose a president by casting secret ballots. Gore lost but refused to concede, and now we're right back to hearing who the polls say should be president. Gore's lawyer, David Boies, fast becoming the William Ginsburg of the 2000 election, argued that the unambiguous 7-day deadline for election returns imposed by Florida law is optional. In short order, the media took up the cudgel. Who's to say? There are arguments on both sides. Democrats and Republicans are both just playing politics. And giving the final patina of legitimacy to a crackpot argument, the Florida Kangaroo Court interpreted 7 days, as written in the law, to mean 19 days. That really happened. Only a Democrat could come up with such brazenly illogical arguments. Gore insists on manual recounts, but he wants manual recounts in only 3 heavily Democratic counties in a single state, so that every vote will count. Democrats denounce the butterfly ballot as racist and borderline sadistic, but the ballot was designed by and its use approved of by Democrats. Democrats claim a manual recount will remedy the dastardly butterfly ballot, which caused confused old people to vote for someone other than Gore by mistake. But they have not explained how a manual recount is going to help people who claim they voted for the wrong candidate. Democrats claim Gore voters were intimidated from approaching the polls, which I suppose is possible if Gore voters follow traffic laws as well as they follow voting laws. But they have not explained how a manual recount will rectify alleged voter intimidation. It is all utterly incoherent, but coherence is irrelevant. Only spin matters. Al Gore and the Democrats will say anything, do anything to win. November 30th, 2000. A Florida legislative committee recommends a special session to name the state's 25 representatives to the Electoral College. December 1st, 2000. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on the Florida Supreme Court's extension of the election deadline. December 4, 2000. The U.S. Supreme Court vacates the Florida Supreme Court's decision and remands to the court with instructions to please read the Constitution and federal law next time. National Lampoon's Florida Supreme Court vacation, December 6, 2000. Despite morale-boosting claims in the mainstream media that the U.S. Supreme Court's unanimous ruling didn't really do anything, or, as Al Gore put it, Twilight Zone theme music here was neutral, perhaps even favorable, the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion just knocked the air out of the Supreme Court of Florida. Scoff law. For openers, the Supreme Court vacated scoff law's silly ruling. The court could have remanded with instructions without vacating the decision. The court could have declined to review the decision altogether, as scores of legal experts swore up and down it would. Not least of all, the court could have affirmed the opinion as a proper exercise of scoff law's judicial powers. As Florida's learned state senator Debbie Wasserman explained on CNN's Crossfire, there is something called the separation of powers and the system of checks and balances, and the judicial